Hello, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to part two of The Origins of the Oral Torah for Torah in Motion. I shared the source sheet for this class in the chat, and I'll share my screen soon as well. Like last time, what I'll do is I'll lecture, and periodically I will try to stop to address the questions in the chat, as well as take additional questions. If people want to unmute themselves at that time and ask questions, I will do my best to entertain them. So last week, we introduced the topic and we discussed some of the key statements of Chazal, of our sages, about the nature of the Oral Torah and what exactly was given at Har Sinai. In this class, I want to go further and deeper into the topic and the history, exploring how both the Gaonim and the Rishonim grappled with the question of what it means for the Oral Torah to be from Sinai. And I'm particularly concerned here with the question of machloket, or dispute. When we look at halacha, we see so much dispute in the Mishnah, the Gemara, and beyond. And at some level, we have to figure out if there was a body of law, a large body of law given at Har Sinai, why then in subsequent generations is there so much continued dispute about the nature of halacha and what a person should do. So let me now share the source sheet and we'll jump in. All right, let me make it a little bigger. Okay. Can everyone see the sheet well? Looks good. Okay, great. Excellent. So the first people to take an opinion on this question about the development of Machloket and its origins are the Gaonim. The Gaonim are the leaders of the Jewish people who lived in the era, let's say, from around the year 700 to 1000. There are names like Rav Sadia Gaon, you may have heard of Rav Shira Gaon, Rav Shmuel ben Chafni Gaon, and others. And the main thing that these rabbis have to say about our question is that actually Chazal, the sages of the Mishnah and the Gemara, did not create new halacha. Everything comes from tradition, presumably going back all the way to Har Sinai. And I think the clearest explication of the Gaonim's position is actually found in a later source, and that's the Sefer HaKabbalah of Rav Avram ben David, Rav Abram ibn Daud, who lived in the 12th century in Spain. And I'll read to you what he has to say. And source number one. Ze Sefer HaKabbalah kasvenuhu lehodia letamidim ki kol dir Rav Seinu Zal chachmei Mishnah v'atam kula mikubalim chacham gadol v'tzadik mipi chacham gadol v'tzadik. The purpose of the Book of Tradition is to provide students with the evidence that all the teachings of our rabbis of blessed memory, namely the sages of the Mishnah and the Talmud, have been transmitted. Each great sage received from the great sage before. And if you skip a few lines down to the next paragraph, he says, V'imachshoch adam lomar v'bnei ma'ash nechelku b'kam makomos. But still, how do we deal with the fact that there seems to be so much dispute in many places? V'kach ani misupak b'divrim, and therefore people say I'm confused. You can retort bluntly and inform that he is a rebel against the court. Why? That our rabbis never differed with respect to a commandment in principle, but only with respect to a detail. That they heard it from their rabbis. They didn't ask enough about all the ramifications and the specifics, because they had not waited on their masters sufficiently. And he says, that's why you never find that anyone disputes whether you light Shabbos candles. What's the dispute about? Just what do you light with and what do you not light with? So if we just unpack this a little bit, it's interesting. What he's saying is that really everything was passed down. And the reason there's machlokas is because they didn't ask their teachers sufficiently about what to do in all situations. So when it comes to certain ramifications, over time, it became more difficult. Some of the other approaches of the Gaonim, in a similar fashion, they'll say that yes, everything was transmitted, but why is there machlokas? Why is there dispute? Well, that's because people forgot that things were not transmitted properly. The students didn't attend to their teachers in the right way, and therefore there was dispute because things were forgotten and had to be reconstructed. If you look at source number two in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, we actually see something of this approach already. It says, "Misha Rabu Tamidi Shammai VeHillel Shloshim Shukol Sarkan." When Shammai and Hillel, two of the great Tanaim, had students who didn't you know sufficiently listen. However, Rabu Machlokas BiYisrael V'Nasis Torah K'Shnei Torahs. That's the time of period when there was a lot of dispute and the Torah became like two Torahs. So we see this idea that over time there was a sort of a pristine revelation according to the Gaonim at Har Sinai. Over time, things became degraded as people forgot, or as more things developed and needed to find more answers, and there was just a breakdown of the tradition. So that's the approach of the Gaonim. Now, I'll pause in a minute, but you're going to ask me, so what do we do with the fact we have all these drashot? We discussed this before in the last class. There are so many instances where it seems like Chazal will say, you know, how do we know to do something? And they'll say, oh, there's a pasuk. We can derive it. We have a toolbox of interpretations, and we can derive what to do from the Torah itself. So how do you explain all these derivations? So I guess one way is to assume that maybe that's exactly what happened, that things were forgotten, so they had to reinvent them kind of by finding psukim. The other approach, I suppose, is kind of what we talked about last time, where sometimes when a midrash is presented by the rabbis, they're not presenting a new halacha based on that midrash. They're using it as a support only to a pre-existing tradition, and they find that the pasuk is a good support to that. So in fact, this is indeed what the Rabbah, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon in the 14th century in Spain, said in his introduction to his commentary on the Torah in source number three. If you just look at the parts that are bolded, he says, "V'zeh shehem samchu elu hadivarim ha'amitiim mikubarim lahem mitzvah satorah v'sukim ahem, liyosum kidmus remes v'asmach lidvarim ahem. V'lo shiyeh datim shiyeh motzi elu hadinim elu makomos." Chazal supported these traditions about the Torah's commandments with verses that are like hints and support to these things. They're not actually deriving laws from those places. If you skip to the next bolded part, Evelheim etzla mikubalim ish mi pi ish ad Moshe Rabbeinu ubikshu lehem remes ben akasu. Rather, they were passed down from person to person back to Moshe, our teacher, and Chazal merely sought a hint from the written Torah. So in short, just to summarize, the Gaonim's position is that there was a revelation at Har Sinai. It was all-encompassing. Things were either forgotten or not passed down appropriately, and therefore there came to be dispute. And when Chazal darshan psukim, what they are doing is merely finding a support to a pre-existing tradition. And so, all right, so let me pause here for a moment, and let me just look first at the questions in the chat, and then I'll open the floor up. Could you share the sheet again? Yes. I have now shared, oh wait, let me see, hold on, sorry. I have now shared the sheet again to everyone. Let's see, Ariel Siegel asks, "I've heard this opinion in Yeshiva that there was no machloka till the age of Hillel. However, we have the clear machlokas of forgetting of the permissibility of Moabite women, which legitimates David's line. There are presumably other disputes that Chazal mentioned as occurring during biblical times. How would the Gaonim deal with that?" That's a good question. I don't know specifically how the Gaonim deal with that with that example. I don't know if the Gaonim would, for example, go as far to say that there was no dispute before Hillel and Shammai. I imagine within their framework of that, as soon as there were students who were not getting everything exactly that their rabbis would say, there could already be room for dispute. So you could perhaps read that already into their opinion. That's a possibility. You haven't mentioned the innovative work on this question by Ibn Ezra predated Ibn Daud in Spain. What did Ibn Ezra say directly about this question? I'm actually curious to hear, Dr. Lancaster. If you want to speak up, feel free.
Hi, sorry, I couldn't unmute. Sure. Well, it would take a whole class. I have offered, Torah in Motion, a whole class on Ibn Ezra. It's in my book. I mean, he said loads because he followed Sarja Gaon, who's quite well known, and he went further because of the Karaites denying it all in Spain, where he lived from 1089, then travelled and died in 1164. So I think Ibn Daud is actually taking a lot from him, to be honest. But I don't want to interrupt your lesson. I'm just surprised because, you know, Ralbag also got a lot from Ibn Ezra as well. I mean, he said he was quite complicated. He really said that they didn't know grammar, the Beth Din of the time. However, they had a sort of superior knowledge. And then he uses some amazing incidents in Tanakh, or even not in Tanakh, but in Humash, where, you know, it's sort of like what we call a gap in the text. And it's the oral Torah that comes in. But he says it's not really innovative because, like, the Dayanim and the rabbis knew better. They knew the text better than we do. But, I mean, he really is a very major person. You know, he's the first Bible scholar in Spain. And he's been incredibly influential altogether.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
I mean, my book is called Deconstructing the Bible. And I know that in Canada and America, you know, every reasonable university has got a copy. And I think Ibn Ezra is grossly overlooked in a lot of scholarship, you know, obviously, that's going still. But thank you for asking. I don't want to take over your, you know, class.
No, but thank you for that. It's a good reference. And I certainly encourage people to look at it. I'll take a look at it myself. I've certainly, Ibn Ezra is very, very important Bible commentator. In that time period. And I personally did not, I knew a lot, you know, I knew about his commentary and stuff like that, but I did not necessarily know so much about his opinion on these particular issues. So I do appreciate you bringing that to my attention. One thing you said, which is interesting, and I actually wanted to talk about just for a minute, is what's the deal with the Gaon's position, basically? Like, why do they say this? Now, as I think we saw in the last class already, like, there are statements in Chazal that certainly dovetail with this very well. Things about, you know, everything being given at Har Sinai, even the particulars of the Oral Torah and stuff like that. So we do have that already. We have that source in Sanhedrin also we looked at about things being pretty okay until the Talmidim of Shammai and Hillel, and then there starts being dispute. But another thing that people do talk about, that scholars of this do talk about, is that the Gaonim to a certain extent are polemicizing against the Karaites. The Karaites were this group that were very active in this time of the Gaonim, who were saying essentially that there is no oral tradition and that we have our own way of interpreting the text of the Torah itself. And that's how we're going to figure out halacha. And they, in fact, they developed sort of their own principles of interpretation. And the Gaonim are then saying, you know, look, no, we have our oral tradition. It goes back to Sinai. And they feel very important to maintain the maximalist approach to that tradition because they don't want the Karaites coming in and saying, no, there is no tradition at all. So some people have made that link. And what's also interesting about this position of the Gaonim and perhaps others, is that it keeps coming back up. Like, it's not like, you know, this was one period in time and everyone said this and then everyone said something different. No, over time you see many different scholars and commentators in different time periods adopting this position of the Gaonim. I mean, it's very simple. I think that's one advantage of it. We're going to see, for example, in the next class that Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch in Germany in the 19th century adopts a variant sort of this very view. But it's important to note that he also was combating Reform and other people who were trying to say that there was no oral tradition. So it becomes an important position to sort of combat those trends, to say that there really is this very, because it emphasizes the strength of the oral tradition. So I think that's our starting point here. What I'd like to do now, though, then, is if there's no further questions right now, I want to move on to the second position, which is that of the Rambam. And the Rambam takes a very different view. And he says in his Hakdamala, the Pirush Mishnayos, his introduction to his commentary on the Mishnah, which was originally written in Arabic, he tries to explain why he disagrees with the Gaon's position and what his view is. And if you look at the parts I bolded here. V'ka'asher meis'ol v'shalom, when Moshe died, u'kvar masa li'Yoshua perushim sh'nisnulo, he already gave to Yoshua everything that God gave to him. V'isku behem Yoshua v'anshei doro, and Yoshua and his generation learned all that. V'chol ma shekibu mimenu hu o echad hazakenim ein bo masa umatav lo naflo ba'machok. So anything that was transmitted to Yoshua or further down the line, there is no dispute about any of that. But anything which they didn't explicitly hear, that's where machlokas developed, in certain particulars. And then they can figure out what to do in those cases that were not transmitted by use of the 13 principles of interpretation that we talked about last time. And he says those principles of interpretation were given at Sinai. These are the 13 principles by which the Torah is darshed, and things like Kavah Chomer, Gezerah Shavah. We talked a little bit about that last time. And the Rambam, in fact, then develops three categories, which you'll see kind of as the source goes on. I'm not going to read it all inside, but what the Rambam essentially says is that if something was transmitted from Moshe all the way down, there is no machlokas. This is true even if it can be independently derived from the Torah, it's from the Torah's text. He says there is also no machlokas in a category of things called halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai. At its most basic level, halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai basically means that we don't have a particular scriptural pasuk or verse to attach the law to, but this is indeed something that we know was transmitted all the way back to Sinai. There are other ways to interpret it, but just for the sake of simplicity, we'll say that. One difficulty with the Rambam's approach here, that there's no machlokas and no dispute about halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, is that there are many things in the Gemara that are considered halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai that people still debate. So that's a problem you have to solve in the Rambam, and there are various different ways to do that, but we're not going to get into that here. But I think most interesting for our purposes here is the Rambam's third category. These are the things that are not transmitted. These are the things that are learned out from the text of the Torah. That Chazal had the ability to do this, to take the text of the Torah and learn new halachos, things that were not taught and not passed down. And about those, of course, there can be machlokas, because you can have different ways of deriving a halacha from the Torah, and disputes about what the Torah should mean and what the Torah does mean, and those interpretive disputes themselves give rise to machlokas. And then in the last bolded paragraph over here, the Rambam says, Avosfaras mishachashav shagam hadinim sheish b'machlokas kalei Moshe. Those who say that there are things that were received from Moshe that people still fight about, b'nafel b'hem machlokas mach mustalas b'kabala o shechacha, and people say that the reason dispute arose is because they made a mistake or they forgot. And whose position is that? That's the Megonu's position. And they say that one was right and one was wrong, or is forgotten, or they didn't hear from their teacher everything they needed to hear. People of that approach bring a proof from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which says that after a certain point in time, the Torah was made like two Torahs because the Talmidim of Hillel and Shammai did not do everything they needed to do. He says, as God lives, this is a very strange thing. It's not true at all. And he says, we're suspecting then people who cast aspersions, I wrote here, on the men from whom we saved the Torah, and all of this is null. So he says, the reason I cannot accept the Gaonim's position, that things were forgotten over time, is because he says that the Kabbalah, the transmission, has to be pristine. We don't want to say that our sages, our rabbis, our teachers made mistakes in the way they transmitted things. So for the Rambam, then, the reason we have dispute is not because there's a mistake in transmission or forgetfulness, but because there were certain things that were simply left unsaid at Sinai. And with regard to those things, Chazal interpreted the Torah and came up with different opinions sometimes about what to do. So that is the Rambam's position. And in source number 5, the Rambam goes somewhat further, I would say. This is his Sefer HaMitzvot. This is also written in Arabic originally. And let me read the bolded parts here. He says, Hashorash Hasheni She'ein Roy Limnos Koma Shalomdi Ma'achas Mishlosh Shemidos Sha'atoran Adreshadem Oberiboy. Says, so he's here the Rambam is counting the 613 mitzvos in the Torah. He's trying to figure out, when we talk about the Torah having 613 mitzvos, which it says in the Gemara and Makos, how do we count those mitzvos? What are the 613? And many of the Rishonim and many people tried to figure out the count, and they came up with different counts. But in any event, the Rambam here is giving you principles about how to do the count. And he says the second principle is that it's inappropriate to count anything derived from one of the 13 midos with which the Torah is explicated. And he says that we already explained in the introduction to our commentary on the Mishnah that most of the laws of the Torah are derived through the 13 midot, and that regarding a law Michelle, Adinayotim Ibina, Melosin Amidos, Hine Pamim Tipo Bomachlokas. And sometimes something that's learned through the 13 Midos, there can be dispute about those things. And then if you go to the bottom there, skip to the next bolded part. Lefika Charoi Baza, Shikoma Shalotim Zub Kasa Batora, Batim Seo Batamaj, Lamdu Bachos and Shoshu Midos, that anything that is written, not found written in the Torah, but is instead found in the Gemara, is being derived from one of the 13 Midos. If they explain this is a primary aspect of Torah or it's Doraisa, it is appropriate to count. Because those that received it say it's Doraisa. If they don't explain this or speak about it, then it's Derabanan. So what the Rambam is adding here to what he said before is A, actually, this third category, which he talked about in Perash HaMishnah, in his commentary to the Mishnah, as being able to have machlokas, because these are things that were derived later and not given at Sinai, this is the row of Dinei Torah. This is actually the majority of things, of halachos in the Torah. The majority of things were not said directly at Sinai and were derived later, and there can be machlokas. And then when he says these things that have machlokas about them, he says these should not be counted as the primary 613 mitzvot because they are not deoraita, they're not considered from the Torah, rather they're derabanan. And anything that's derabanan should not be counted as one of the 613 mitzvot. So that, in a nutshell, and again, I'm broadly oversimplifying, that is the Rambam's position. So let me look again at the chat. Whose translation are you using for the Sefer HaMitzvot? So the Hebrew translation here. I think this is what the one that was simply available on Bar Ilan and Sfaria. It may not be the most up to date or the most accurate one. I will admit that, and I know that there are differences when it comes to the translation about how exactly you figure out what the Rambam was saying. Yeah, it's a good point. Or that what was given to Moshe were the methods for deriving oral law from written Torah. Yeah, so right, in the opinion of the Rambam at least, the principles themselves, the 13 Midos, were indeed given at Har Sinai, and it was those methods, those Sinai-approved methods, which are the way that the Chazal derived new halachos. Ariel says, Rabbi Yonatan Kolach, in his work on the Mefarshim, has a good overview of the rise of Karaism in his chapter on Sadia Gaon. Okay, yeah, thank you for that. Does anyone else want to speak up and say anything else about the Rambam or the Gaonim or anything else we've said so far? Okay. In that case, I can proceed further. You might wonder how we get from the Gaonim to the Rambam. The Gaonim had one very particular opinion about there being no dispute about anything, about there being a full revelation and sort of dispute arising afterwards because of problems in transmission. And the Rambam very vehemently rejects this and says, no, there were no problems in transmission and some things simply weren't given. So it could be, first of all, there are sources that we talked about in Chazal for both ideas. The Gaonim may be relying on those that saw a more maximalist approach to what was given at Har Sinai, everything, in other words. And the Rambam may be relying on other Gemaras that we saw, where it seems like later interpreters had a much larger role in determining the what the Torah is meant to be, and give authority to Chazal to do such things. The Rambam also, in many ways, in his time period, was rebelling in certain ways against the Gaonim. When he wrote the Mishnah Torah, his great, halacha commentary, he says basically, you don't have to go back to all the sources anymore to figure out the halacha. You can look at my Mishnah Torah and you can simply read it and use it to determine the halacha. And he's really setting himself apart from the Gaonim as a new halachic authority. If the Gaonim were very focused on what their teachers had done in general when they paskin halacha, the Rambam and those that came after him were often going back to the Gemara and paskining on their own a lot more, and not only following the words of their teachers. And perhaps the Rambam saw Chazal is doing the same thing and being creative. It's also interesting that the Rambam is very much playing up the authority of the rabbis themselves to interpret and to create new halacha. And this is something that we're going to see in a moment. Others do as well, and maybe perhaps even in a stronger way. But we already see a little bit in the Gemara. There's a Gemara I didn't put on the source sheet in Bava Basra, where Amemar says the words Chacham Adif Minavi, that a sage is superior to a prophet. And I think we're going to come back to that statement at some point, perhaps in the final shir. But for now, it's relevant to the Rambam's position because it really gives a great deal of authority to the sages. If we think of a Navi as someone who spoke directly to Hashem and transmitted Hashem's words, but the sage in some way can actually be superior. The sage who comes to his own interpretation, his own conclusions, perhaps based on the words of the Torah, perhaps that itself is considered very valuable. So I just wanted to explore that briefly about the Rambam's approach. Asher Stein, did the Gaonim use the Yerushalmi? I'm not recalling now offhand whether the Gaonim had access to the Yerushalmi. I know that the Gaonim very much often disputed the Minhage Eretz Yisrael and the things that were going on in Eretz Yisrael, and often tried to assert their authority over that. For example, when it came to the Siddur, the Gaonim had a tremendous role in standardizing the text of the Siddur and what people should be saying, and often rejecting the traditions of Eretz Yisrael, which in many ways, some of those traditions did not continue as robustly after the Gaonim's Siddurim spread through the diaspora. So that's at least one data point. I don't know exactly, though, about their use of the Yerushalmi. I'd have to look that up. So let's talk a little bit about the Ramban, the great 13th century Torah commentator. So the first thing I want to look at in the Ramban is how he actually disagrees with the Rambam in the Sefer HaMitzvot. We just saw in the Sefer HaMitzvot that the Rambam said that if something is learned out from one of the 13 Midos, if something is derived by Chazal, it's derabanan, and we're not going to count it as one of the 613 Mitzvos. And the Ramban disagrees with that. And he says that things that are learned out of the 13 Midot, those should actually be Doraisa. Those should be considered Torah level law, and they should be counted. I'm not going to read the whole piece in the Ramban here. He also says some things that are a little hard to understand. Like he says, for example, that he thinks that the Rambam is actually disagreeing with the whole idea of the 13 principles themselves being handed down at Sinai. I don't really see that in the text of the Rambam himself, but that's the way he's reading the Rambam, and he disagrees with that greatly. But he's also disagreeing with the point that he thinks these things should be counted as Doraisa. And if you look at the bolded part, he says, "Va'anu lo matzinu das chachamim bazeh," and we don't find the sages agreed with the Rambam here. Shamidos kulam etzlam kadavar mefurash b'Torah b'dorshinos amidatam. For the principles of interpretation were as if they were written explicitly in the Torah, and the sages darshened them at will. Ulufi zeh haroi hu shenamar behefach. So he says the proper thing is to say the opposite of the Rambam. Shekol davar hanidrash b'talmud ba'achas mikol shlosh esvei midos hu midoraisa ash nishmo sam shimur shu hasmachta. And therefore, it is appropriate to say that everything the Talmud darshan from one of the 13 midot is doraita, unless we hear them say that the scriptural proof is itself merely a peg, just merely a reference to a received tradition. But what the Ramban is kind of saying here is that there's really a lot of authority that Chazal have. That once the Chazal have these midos, once Chazal have these 13 principles that were handed down from Sinai, they are able to actually establish Torah level law with these principles. And that even if at Sinai we don't have a maximalist revelation where every single halacha was handed down, authority was granted to the rabbis to expand the Torah, to expand halacha, to use these principles to learn out a whole bunch of new halacha. And we also see this in the Ramban's commentary on the Torah. And this is in source number 7. And the Ramban here is commenting on the pasuk, on the verse which says that you should lo tasor, that you should not deviate from the words of the rabbis, yamin u'smol, right or left. And the Ramban here explains, ve'in yano, afilu tachsho b'libacha shehem toim, even if you think in your heart the rabbis are mistaken, v'adara pashut b'inecha kasher ata yodeya b'in yamincha l'smolcha, and you think it's as obvious they're mistaken as the difference between your right and left, tasa k'mitzvasam, you have to do as they command. And if you skip down to the next bolded part, And the need for this commandment is very great. Ki haTorah nitna lanu b'ktav, because the Torah was given in writing, in written form. V'yaduhu shelo yishtavu adeos b'chol advarim hanoladim. And not everyone's going to concur on newly arising matters. V'hinei yirbu hamachlokos b'tasa Torah kama toros. There's going to be a lot of disagreements, and the one Torah will become many. V'chazach lanu hakasav hadin, shenishma lebeis din hagadol ha'omid lifnei Hashem b'makom asher yivchar. And the pasuk over here is telling us that you have to listen to the rabbis, and you have to listen to the rabbis who are actually at the Beit HaMikdash. So we're talking here about the Sanhedrin, the Beit Din HaGadol, the great court. B'chol mashi yomru lanu b'pir shetor, you have to listen to everything they tell them, tell you about the explanation of the Torah. Bein shekilu perusho eid mi pi eid u'moshe mi pi agavura, whether it's a tradition that they've received mouth from mouth all the way back to Moshe, osh yomrum kein lefi mashmaus hamikor o kavanasa, or they, whether they say their interpretation based on the implication of the written words of the Torah or its intent. So again, over here, the Ramban is saying an important principle that whether or not something was transmitted or whether or not something is learned out of the text of the Torah itself, the rabbis have the authority to do that. Part and parcel of the revelation at Har Sinai was not just a transmission of straight law, but it was also a granting of authority to the rabbis to continue to interpret the Torah as needed. And we see this very clearly, I think, in the source number 8 over here of Yosef Albo in the 15th century Spain, who wrote the Sefer HaYikar. And he says, V'od lefi she'iyav shar she'tiyah Torah Hashem Yisbarach shleima ba'ofen she'taspik b'chol hazmanim. The law of God cannot be perfect so as to be adequate for all times. Lefi she'apratim ha'mitchadshim tamid b'nyanei ha'anashim, because there's so many new details about things that happen and things that change around human society and what we do. And also, their customs and their acts are too numerous to be embraced in a book. Therefore, Moshe was given orally certain general principles only briefly alluded to in the Torah. By means of which the wise men in every generation may work out the details as they appear. So if Yosef Abel is saying very clearly this idea is like the way we understand when we say Torah Shebaal Peh mi Sinai, when we say the oral Torah from Sinai, what we mean is that one of the things that was transmitted at Sinai was a set of principles. And these principles could be used by the rabbis then to learn out new things in later generations. So from the Gaonim to the Rambam and the Ramban and Rav Yosef Abba, we've moved very far. We've moved from an all-encompassing revelation to a smaller revelation after, but a revelation that included general principles that could be used to learn out new rules. And the authority was given to the rabbis in every generation, at least up through the times of Chazal, up through the times of the Mishnah and the Gemara, to make those interpretations and to create the halachic system. So I know we've covered a lot of ground here. So I do want to pause again here. I do want to pause again here for different points. We have here, Dr. Arvin Lancaster says this is where the Ramban was much influenced by Ibn Ezra. Don't you, thank you for pointing that out. Sure. Are you saying that the Ibn Ezra would agree with the Ramban, that he was saying that?
No, Ibn Ezra, as you know, is earlier, and he was the first to mention about Asafta, which you pointed out, and also the fact that, the fact is you have to follow the leaders, that which is what I said earlier, the spiritual, otherwise it'd be chaos. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because Ramban in other ways was quite critical of Ibn Ezra, but because he always supported the authorities of the time, despite being so good at grammar and, criticizing Rashi, et cetera, on this because he came earlier. So that's why he said he should be including Mikraot Gedolot. Sorry, I'm not trying to, this is not criticism. This is just saying it's very exciting that Ibn Ezra, the very first Bible commentator in Spain of any religion and such a genius, who traveled all over and ended up in England, actually, it was a precursor of these people who in many ways are more famous. That's all I'm trying to say,
No, very interesting. Yeah.
Thank you for letting me say it. It's very kind of you.
No, I much appreciate it. Is there any other questions or comments on anything we've said so far or any other questions? I'd be happy to take them at this point. Okay. I will continue then. Yeah. And I do think you see something kind of interesting in this shift from the Gaonim to the Rambam and some of the others that we just discussed now, is if we look at the Gaonim, the Gaonim are really seeing Chazal, are really seeing the sages of the Mishnah and the Gemara as the transmitters of tradition or the bearers of tradition. And I think we particularly see in Ramban and Rav Yosef Albo this idea that Chazal are, of course, I don't think they would disagree that they're bearers of a tradition from Sinai, but they're also, I think they emphasize even more that they're the authoritative interpreters of tradition, that they have a much more active role in the processing of that tradition and in the creation of the halachic system. What I want to do with the remaining time, although it's possibly will end early, unless there's a lot more questions, is I want to look at what I have here in part number four of the shiur, which I'm calling the Ritva and the Ranz approach, which some people have said is a slightly different way of conceptualizing of the origins of dispute, and what we understand the scope of Torah miSinai to be in terms of Torah Shebaal Peh, what actually of the Oral Torah was given at Har Sinai. And the important starting source here is Masechet Sofrim. Masechet Sofrim was written probably in the 7th or 8th century. It's one of what we call Masechtos Ketanos, one of the small tractates. It's not part of the Gemara itself. It was a work compiled by the Gaonim in the early Gaonic period. And we have a statement here of Amar Rav Yonai, Torah Shenasana Kodesh Baruch Hu LeMoshe, the Torah that God gave Moshe, Nitnalo Ba'arba'im V'tisha Panim Tameh, Uva'arba'im V'tisha Panim Tahor. It was given to him where there are 49 ways something might be impure and 49 ways something might be pure. So it's a little hard to understand on its face exactly what Masechet Sofrim is talking about, but it seems to indicate that there was a lot already given to Moshe. There was a lot of sort of indecision in a way, that there are many times when you look at something, let's say whether something is pure or impure, you might be able to make many arguments on both sides. And Masechet Sofrim is suggesting that all those things were transmitted to Moshe. Let's look at the way the Ritva understands. The Ritva is also in Spain in the 13th century. I believe from the Ramban school, he's often considered a student. And he says, Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim chayim. When the Gemara says that these and these are the words of the living God, which is a principle that is sometimes applied in halacha, that if we have two different opinions, both opinions are considered acceptable. So he says, Shalu rabbanei tzarfas, heach efsher shiyu shneim divrei Elokim chayim, v'ze osa v'ze matir. The rabbis in France asked, how is it possible that two things could be the words of God if they're opposite? Let's say one opinion says this thing is permitted, and one opinion says this thing is prohibited. How can they both be correct? When Moshe went up on high, lekabel Torah, to receive the Torah, herulah kol davar v'davar, memtes panim le'iser, memtes panim le'heter. He was shown 49 ways to prohibit something and 49 ways to permit it. V'shalda kodesh baruch hu alza, and he says, what am I supposed to do with this? He asked God, what do I do with this? For amr sheyehezeh maser l'chachmei Yisrael shebechol dor v'dor v'yeh hachra kamosam. He said, this is given over to the sages of Israel in every generation, and the decision as to prohibit or permit will be according to them. So what I think what the Ritva is saying is that Hashem at Har Sinai did not just hand down a toolbox full of interpretive principles. If you look at the Rambam and the Ramban, maybe that's more what they're saying. They're saying that there was these 13 midos that were given to, entrusted to the rabbis so that they could come up with new halachos. I think the Ritva is saying is that everything was already sort of encoded in this at the outset. Everything was shown to Moshe. There were all these possibilities for the way halacha could develop, but that it was then given over to the sages themselves to decide in each generation how it was actually going to come out in actuality. But in a way that this is all sort of if you can imagine, this is all like in the DNA of revelation. That the Torah Shebaal Peh, even if not directly transmitted, all at Har Sinai, it's all in its DNA. In that there's a certain flexibility that Chazal are given for how things should develop, but that these things were all foreseen in some respect at Har Sinai and can be all be seen as Sinaitic. I think you can definitely see and hear echoes of what we talked about in the last class of the Gemara in Menachot, where Moshe sees Rabbi Akiva's class. Rabbi Akiva doesn't understand what Rabbi Akiva is saying, but nonetheless, Rabbi Akiva, we're taught that those things are all stem back from Sinai in some respect. That even if Rabbi Akiva is learning out new things, all of that is sort of part and parcel of revelation at Har Sinai. It all stems from it in some way. You may also be thinking that this, in some ways, sounds similar to the other Gemara we saw, that that everything that Hashem showed Moshe, kol dikduke Torah v'dikduse sofrim, all the new things that the sofrim are going to say in the future, that Moshe already saw those. And perhaps, as we saw last time also, those things Moshe was just shown. They were not transmitted to him, though. They were simply shown to him. And I think we see this connection in the work of the Ran, in his Drashot HaRan, which is his philosophical treatise. He lived in the 14th century. And the Ran says, Aval inyan kachu shekol ha-Torah shebiksav hasheh ba'al peh nimsu ela Moshe b'Sinai kamo she'amru b'Megillah. That he says that the Torah written in Or was given to Moshe on Sinai, and he quotes the Gemara we just mentioned. Amar Bechia bar Avin, Amar Biyochanan, my diksiv, Valeim kechoad vari, Malaman Shereo Kadosh Baruch Hu Moshe, Kol Dikduke Torah, Dikduke Sofrim, Masha Sofrim, Asidim Lichadesh, Mainu Mikra Megillah. And we infer that the Gemara says we infer that Hashem showed Moshe all the Torah's deductions and all the scribes' deductions and what the scribes were destined to originate. And over there is talking about reading the Megillah, but anyway, that's not directly relevant to what we're saying. But he says, the Ran continues, Dikdufei Sofrim, Hema Amachlokas Vichiluke Sfaros Shebein Chachmi Yisrael. That the scribes' deductions are all the disputes and differences of view among the Torah scholars. But Kulan Namdan Moshe Rabbeinu Amipi Agvora. And actually, Moshe was taught all of this. And the decision, though, was going to be according to the sages of the respective generations. So he's saying that everything was encoded at Sinai already, that Moshe was sort of shown everything in the way things could develop, but that Moshe, with the authority to actually develop them and to share them, was given to the sages in every generation. So on the one hand, I think we have some similarities to the Ramban in playing up the authority of the rabbis to decide halacha, but I think in some ways we have a new approach also, where this is all part of revelation in some way. That it's not just that principles were handed down at revelation, but that all sort of the different opinions were already part and parcel of revelation in some respect, and merely developed and sort of came to fruition over time. And I think that might be the difference between the approach of the Ritva and the Ran and some of the earlier approaches that we saw. So again, I'll pause here. And curious to hear if you have any thoughts on this approach or any of the approaches we discussed, because all I really have at this point is a summation of what we talked about, but that's the extent of the material I wanted to present in this class.
Hi, this is Martin.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
Do you think that this would have been as much of a problem as it was if we wouldn't have the first Mishnah and Pirkei Avos?
So the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, you're talking about the Mishnah that talks about how everything was handed down, essentially. Moshe to Yoshua to the Zakenim and onward. But you mean if we didn't have that Mishnah, you're saying that we would say, sure, yeah, things developed later, but the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos makes it kind of seem that like everything was handed down. Sure, that could be. I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, I think that's certainly one of the sources that you could use to create a more maximalist structure, where really everything was handed down.
I mean, there's also in Sanhedrin the people who don't have a chelek in Olam Haba, those mm-hmm. that ascribe, you know, non-Sinaitic thing to anything. So the Sanhedrin plus Pirkei Avot seem to reinforce that maximalist view.
Well, is the Sanhedrin, though, talking more about the written Torah?
Yeah, I think, is there something about every Kal V'chomer?
Yeah, you're right. There is something about every Kal V'chomer as well. Right. So that would seem, right. So that could also be seen as showing that everything was handed down at Har Sinai. But yeah, I'm not specifically familiar with the interpretations that people give to that Gemara, but obviously those that say there were a lot of things that are derived later, like many of the authorities that we've explored in this year, are going to have to figure out in some way how to deal with those sources that give a more maximalist approach. And I think, as we discussed in the first class, one of the ways to do that is simply say they're not meant to be taken exactly literally, because there's really a lot of things in the Chazal like that, where we don't necessarily assume that it's all meant to be directly literal. So that could be one way of dealing with that as well. But I think it is clear in this class, at least, what we've seen is that there are a number of authorities that think that there was a significant amount of development when it comes to Torah Sheba'al Peh after the period of Har Sinai, perhaps through the Yud Gimel Midot, perhaps through the 13 principles, or perhaps even through. I mean, one could imagine, I suppose, that there could be other ways. There could be other ways as well if we rely very heavily on the authority of Chazal and we have to listen to them. Then I think, you know, the very fact that they are the bearers of the tradition and the interpreters of the tradition means that they do have a lot of authority to interpret as necessary for the needs of the time. Anything else? Any other questions, comments?
I'd like to ask a question about America.
Sure. Okay.
You know, you don't have a chief rabbi in America, and
right.
American friends have said it's much better without, because there's a machloket now about the coronation on Shabbat.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of us in Manchester think the chief rabbi shouldn't have gone because of Shabbat. I'm not going to get into that because Rabbi Jay was very upset with me. But do you think, I mean, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot. I know Canada has got sort of a chief rabbi. It's probably ours, but he hasn't allowed women to be rabbis even when they are ordained in America Orthodoxy. There's one case who has lectured for Torah in Motion. Do you think it's better that you don't have a chief rabbi? Because I'm wondering, I mean, who is the authority in America, or are there many? Because the ones here are not necessarily they're not scholars always. They have been sometimes, but not always. I'm putting myself on the edge here, but you're such a good lecturer. You know, well, I just wonder what you think.
Well, thank you.
Rabbi Angel, who is 75 and asked me to do an article for him. You know, he was one of the first rabbis of Sheret Yisrael in the 20th century.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and
Sephardi. Yeah.
He's amazing. And I did a major article for them about the situation here. And I'm getting into despair in this country. I think you're much better in America. And I just wonder what you thought about that.
I mean, I'll try to answer it while tying it back to what we've been talking about here to a certain degree, at least. I think we already saw in the Ramban, for example, there's this idea that a centralization of authority can prevent a great deal of debate and dispute. I mean, I think the question you then have to ask, though, is does it really work? Does a centralized authority really, really even do that? And can we really even speak of a centralized authority at any time post, let's say, maybe the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash or something like that? I mean, even then one can wonder maybe, but let's at least take the period of time after that. I think there were always just communities living in so many different places and so many areas that we're never going to have such a centralization of halacha. And I think, you know, part of the reason machlokas develops, and we've explored some of these ideas here, is simply just because there are a lot of different people living in different places, different things are going on, and they all have different ideas about how the Torah should be interpreted. I think when it comes to, let's say, like a chief rabbi or something like that, if a chief rabbi is sort of appointed over a whole lot of people who all have different ideas, maybe some of them are themselves great scholars who are worthy of having their own opinions on halacha, it may not work so well. Case in point, actually, in the early 20th century, they tried having a chief rabbi in the United States of America, at least in the New York area. It was Rabbi Jacob Joseph, who came from Europe, and his idea was to centralize kashrut, because there were so many different butcher shops in New York, all relying on their own standards. No one knew whether they were trustworthy. So they said, we need to get a chief rabbi in here to centralize everything. So the chief rabbi comes, he brings along some other scholars. In fact, one of the people he brought was a Mordechai Kaplan's father, actually, was one of the people who came with him to the United States to run his entourage, essentially, as the chief rabbi. And it did not work out so well, because people were still fighting and people resented the fact that he has authority over him. And even though he was very well-meaning, it did not work out. And he actually, he died very young. People think because of all the stress and because people were really not very nice to him. So at least that historical anecdote would suggest that in a very diverse population, at least, a chief rabbinate may not work very well. But again, I don't want to comment per se on any contemporary issues about Great Britain or Israel for that matter. But yeah,
thank you very much. That was very, I didn't know about Mordechai Kaplan being in charge. I think it's hilarious. You know?
I got a chat here. Yeah. So Holly Bauman says Mordechai Kaplan's father was Orthodox. Yes. Yes. I should have made that clear. But yes, that he did come with the chief rabbi indeed, and he was Orthodox. And Mordechai Kaplan himself was Orthodox at the outset for quite a while. And it's really very interesting, actually, what kind of happened there and how he sort of went in a different direction. But he started off as a very sort of strong and influential Orthodox rabbi in the United States, as did his father. Okay. Well, thank you for the discussion. We have a few more minutes. I'm happy to take any further questions, or if not, I can just do a short summary and then I can see you all next week.
May I, with your permission, just sure. make a comment?
Sure.
Just to put things in perspective, the time span from Matan Torah until the time of the Gaonic period, the end of the Gaonic period, we're talking about something like 2,500 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's an enormous amount of time. The little conversation we just had was talking about a very short period of time, and look at the number of different directions that things have gone in. So mm-hmm. unfortunately, we don't have texts from that time, except for, say for Nehemiah, for example, can give mm-hmm. us, Ezra and Nehemiah can give us some clues about certain kinds of things. But mm-hmm. when you have such enormous time periods, it's very difficult to evaluate exactly what process actually transpired and what drove it.
No, I agree. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's right. I mean, I think that the Gaonim and the Rishonim that we've explored here are trying to reconstruct something that happened a long time ago, and they're trying to figure it out, and they're trying to harmonize all the different sources that are at their disposal to the best of their ability. A historian obviously is going to think about things differently. A historian might not be trying to harmonize all those sources. A historian might not be taking it as axiomatic, for example, there even is a Torah Shabbal Peh. And we talked about this a little bit in the first class about some of those difficulties. We also talked about how in Sefer Nehemiah, for example, we already see that they're interpreting the mitzvah of Sukkah very differently. So we have this disconnect already between the Torah and what they're doing in Sefer Nehemiah and what the rabbis later say we're supposed to do about Sukkah. And that's a question we may get back to in some respect in the last class. I do want to get back to sort of those issues about how we draw a line between the time of the Torah, the time of Tanakh, and the time of Chazal and our times. And can we draw that line? And whether we have to draw that line. And that's, I think it's a really interesting question and something that we are going to get back to and discuss. So stay tuned for that at least. But anyway, I think in this class, we've covered a great deal of ground. Just to summarize, when we talk about the question of what does it mean the Torah Shebaal Peh is from Sinai, the Gaonim take it mostly at face value, say everything was given, machloket is due to forgetfulness. The Rambam says that the rabbis could use the 13 principles to interpret the Torah and to create new laws. And then there is this disagreement about those things. When the Rambam said those things are only then derabanan, if they're learned out by the rabbis, the Rambam disagreed and said, no, those things are d'oraita. This is the bread and butter of the Torah. That's part of the authority that the rabbis have to interpret and to actually make new Torah level laws. And finally, we saw the Ritva and the Ran, that the authority of the rabbis to make new laws is built into the multifaceted nature of revelation itself. Now, you might wonder, do we have to decide between all these views? Do we have to try to figure out who's right? I would say no. And also, I would say, based on also what Asher was saying, we can't. We don't really know what happened. But I think all these views can help us as halachic Jews trying to trace the authority for our halachic system. We can use all these different views to think about how to do that. So sometimes there may be traditions that go really far back and then some things were forgotten. Sometimes Chazal are creating new laws through Drasha. I think that's pretty clear. And we talked about that a little bit last time also. And perhaps, you know, the overarching principle of all this is that Chazal or the Rishonim or the Achronim or the rabbis today, we do believe they're part of a tradition, and part of a chain of transmission. There's something that we call Masorah. And there is a certain authority granted to the bearers of that Masorah to interpret the Torah for their times. As we know, the principle also, lo b'shamayim hi, it's not in heaven. And this interpretation does continue. Exactly the parameters of how to interpret it at any given time, obviously that's a tricky and sensitive question. But certainly the fact that there is an interpretive tradition, I think we can all agree, is something that's important and axiomatic to our lives as religious Jews. So thank you all very much for coming to this class, and I really hope to see all of you again next week. Next week, what I want to do is jump to the 19th century, where we talk about the reform movement in Germany and how some of its scholars and academics raised serious questions about the nature of the Oral Torah and also about the 13 principles and how the Torah is interpreted and how the rabbis of that time tried to respond to those issues. And from that, we'll learn some new perspectives. So again, thank you again. And I hope to see you all next week.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
I'm not a rabbi, but thank you. You're very welcome.
Okay. So what's your title?
I'm a lawyer, so I guess just Mister. I didn't get a title.
Oh, so it's even great to hear a lawyer have so much knowledge.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, have a great day.